It's fairly safe to say about Evan Goldman that she would be opposing this war. She would be opposing the government. She would be pointing to the enormous gap between rich and poor in this country, and the gap, and she would connect the war with the waste of America's wealth, the waste on the military, and the waste by siphoning so much of this wealth into the top 1% of the population.
That's Howard Zinn, and this is Alternative Radio. I'm David Barsamian. This edition of AR features Howard Zinn on Emma Goldman, anarchism, and war resistance. Emma Goldman is largely an unknown figure today. She deserves wider recognition. She was born in Lithuania and died in 1940. She spent many years as an organizer in the United States. She was a major anarchist thinker and activist, as well as a passionate advocate for women's rights. Anarchism today is mostly viewed negatively. It's seen as a synonym for disorder and chaos. Few recognize it as a political philosophy rooted in the ideals of the Enlightenment. Noam Chomsky calls it the libertarian wing of socialism. Anarchism not only opposes the institutions of state coercion and violence, it questions the very legitimacy of the state. To talk about Emma Goldman, anarchism, and other issues is the legendary historian Howard Zinn. He was born in Brooklyn. His parents, poor immigrants, were constantly moving to stay, as he once told me, one step ahead of the landlord. A World War II vet and professor at Spelman College and Boston University, Zinn was at the center of activism and resistance, from the civil rights and anti-Vietnam War movements to Iraq and Afghanistan and the struggle for economic justice. He passed away in January 2010. Arundhati Roy, the great Indian writer, said of him, "He brought secrets and forgotten histories into the light, and in doing so, changed the official narrative the powerful have constructed for us." Since its inception, Howard Zinn was an integral part of alternative radio. Over the years, we aired many of his lectures and interviews. He was a friend and mentor to me and countless others. I was also fortunate enough to collaborate with him on two books, Original Zinn and The Future of History. This classic from the A.R. Zinn Archives, Emma Goldman, Anarchism and War Resistance, was recorded in January 2002 at Radcliffe College in Cambridge, Massachusetts. And now, Howard Zinn.
Okay, I'll start with Emma Goldman and then move into other things, because I can never stay with history. That is, I can never stay with the past. And for me, you know, I became a historian and went into the past really for the purpose of trying to understand and do something about what was going on in the present. So I never wanted to be a historian who sort of goes into the archives and you never hear from him or her again. So yes, my work on Emma Goldman was always connected with, I suppose, the things I was involved in and active in the world. I had vaguely been aware of Emma Goldman. This is interesting, because here I was, a PhD in history. I mean, what could be higher than that? I mean, who could be better informed than a PhD in history? But here I was, with a doctorate from Columbia, and Emma Goldman had never been mentioned in any of my classes, and none of her writings had ever appeared on my reading lists. And it's just that I vaguely remembered reading a chapter about her in an old book called Critics and Crusaders, and there was a little chapter on Emma Goldman. So I had this vague notion about Emma Goldman, but didn't know anything about her. And then I was at some conference in Pennsylvania, and sometimes at conferences you run into interesting people. And I ran into this guy, Richard Drinnen, who's a historian, remarkable historian. Drinnen told me he had written a biography of Emma Goldman, Rebel in Paradise. And so I went to that, and I read his biography, Rebel in Paradise, and it just astonished me. And made me angry about the fact that I had not been told anything about Emma Goldman in my long education. And here was this magnificent woman, this anarchist, this feminist, this fierce, life-loving person. Of course, that led me to her autobiography, Living My Life, which is, if you have not read her autobiography, you should read it. At a certain point, I decided to require it for students, and I had this big class of about 400 students, and I decided to require it for these 400 students. And at first I thought, Living My Life, it's a big book. And will they really connect with this early 20th century woman? Here we are, you know, in the 60s. They loved it. And they found in her what I found her, you know, free spirit, bold, speaking out against all authority, unafraid, and as the title of her book suggests, living my life, living her life as she wanted to live it, not as the, you know, rules and regulations and the authorities were telling her how to live it. So, yeah, that got me interested in Emma Goldman, and as I said, began reading it, began using her stuff in my classes, and then in, it had to be 1975, that's the year the war in Vietnam ended, right? And I'd always been interested in theater. And so, yes, so I wrote a play about Emma Goldman. I had to make a decision. Her life was so long and full, and it's always a decision in any work of art. I like to call what I do a work of art, of course. But any work of art, it's always a problem of what do you leave in and what do you leave out. And there's so much to her life, and so I started with her as an immigrant girl, a teenager, living in Rochester to New York and working in the factory, and her political awareness, taking a leap in 1886 at the time of the Haymarket Affair. How many of you know about the Haymarket Affair? Okay. Always have to take little polls, so I have to know if you're telling people things they already know. Of course, I don't mind telling people things they already know. We all have to be reminded, right? Again and again. But the Haymarket Affair was 1886, midst of labor struggles all over the country for the eight-hour day, and a strike against the International Harvester Company in Chicago. The police come, and, you know, the usual scene, police versus strikers. But the police fire into the strikers, and they kill a number of strikers. And Chicago at that time is a great center for radical activity and anarchist groups. And the anarchists call a meeting, protest meeting, Haymarket Square, and Chicago, and so on. It's a peaceful meeting, but the police barge into the meeting. A bomb explodes in the midst of the police. Terrorist attack. Nobody knows who threw the bomb. But, you know, when a terrorist attack occurs, it doesn't matter whether you know or don't know. You go after somebody. You've got to go after somebody. The police have to find somebody. The FBI have to find somebody. The army has to find somebody, you see. And so they find 8 leading anarchists of Chicago. Nobody can tie them to the throwing of the bomb, but they're anarchists. So, you know, we have conspiracy laws. Conspiracy laws are very interesting. Because with a conspiracy law, you can tie anybody to anything. You don't have to do anything to become the defender in a political conspiracy trial. So they quickly find these 8 anarchists guilty of conspiring to commit murder, and they are sentenced to death. And Emma Goldman is aware of this and goes up to through the courts of appeals, and the American judicial system is a wonderful system. Once gross errors have been made at a lower level, it very often is hard to overcome that because the higher courts will limit themselves in what they can review. And they say, well, the jury and the judge consider the facts in this case, and so all we have to deal with is legal niceties, and we can't go over the facts. But in any case, the Illinois Supreme Judicial Court approved the sentences. There was a point in this when it had become an international case, the Haymarket Affair. One of those cases that captures the imagination of caring people who see an injustice. And, you know, we've, in our time, we've had so many such cases. There were the Rosenbergs, and there was Mumi Abu-Jamal. And, you know, always these cases which become international causes. And that was true of the Haymarket Affair. And George Bernard Shaw wrote, sent a telegram to the Illinois Supreme Court. And he said, if the state of Illinois needs to lose 8 of its citizens, it could better afford to lose the 8 members of the Illinois Supreme Court. You say. Well, it didn't help. but anyway, 4 of them were hanged. And when they were hanged and the news came out and Emma Goldman heard about it, it just excited her to the point of fury. She soon left Rochester, left her family, left a husband, almost an arranged marriage when she was so young, one of those marriages, and left her husband, left her family, went to New York, joined a little anarchist group in New York, met Alexander Berkman, became a comrade and her lover, and then this little group of anarchists living in a collective in New York began putting out literature and handing out, what these little left-wing groups do, you know. Anybody who walks through Park Square or Harvard Square, right, you encounter these people. It's important to pick up their information, pick up those leaflets, because they will tell you things, these funny people, these radical, crazy people, they will tell you things in these little leaflets and pamphlets that you will never hear anywhere else. But anyway, she's part of this little group. And then in 1892, there's a strike that takes place in Homestead, Pennsylvania, against the Carnegie Steel Works, and another very dramatic incident. Pinkerton Detective Agency, which is a euphemism for strikebreakers, the Pinkerton Detective Agency is hired by the Carnegie Corporation. Henry Clay Frick, whom you may know from as a great art patron, also a manager of steelworks and an employer of the Pinkerton strikebreakers. And there's a gun battle, and strikers are killed. And that fires up this little anarchist group in New York, and they decide that they are going to do what has not yet been done in the United States, but has been done a number of times in Europe, and that is they to carry on a symbolic act to show that the perpetrators of violence can also be the victims of violence. They decide to kill Henry Clay Frick. And so they argue about it. You can imagine this little group of, they're not very experienced at this sort of stuff. They're discussing all the night, how will we do this? Where will we get a gun? Berkman volunteers to do it. We have to get him a new suit of clothes. So it'll look, you know, if you're going to kill somebody, you have to look respectable. And so he goes with his clothes and his gun and so on to Pittsburgh. He makes his barges into Henry Clay Frick's office, and he's a very poor shot. He's an anarchist. Now, what do you expect? He isn't, you know, hadn't practiced this stuff. You know, he knows how to hand out leaflets. And he wounds Frick, but he's pounced on. He's quickly tried, sentenced to 22 years in prison. So he's been Emma Goldman's lover, and he goes to prison. And while he's in prison, Emma Goldman becomes a nationally known figure, a lecturer, a writer, a fierce woman. By the way, one of the great books about prison life and prison conditions and about the whole issue of prisons is Alexander Berkman's book, Prison Memoirs of an Anarchist. Not easy to get. Prison Memoirs of an Anarchist. Wonderful book about his, he spent 14 years in prison. And by the time, he came out, things had changed. He and Emma Goldman were no longer lovers, and very soon, but they founded a anarchist magazine together, Mother Earth, and publishing things that nobody else would publish. And they actually, by this time, had changed their minds about the necessity for occasional acts of symbolic violence. I say occasional acts of symbolic violence just to get them off the hook, make it sound nice. But of course, none of these acts were nice. But they pretty much had a rethinking about whether, you know, this is the kind of thing you have to do. You know, they were organizers. And Emma Goldman was an organizer of garment workers in New York while she was speaking all over. And yes, her personal relationship with Alexander Berkman ended, but they were still comrades, publishers of Mother Earth. Now, I guess if you go into the library, you can find the old issues of Mother Earth, fascinating stuff to read. Give you a history of that time that you probably won't get in traditional textbooks. And then Emma Goldman took up with, that's an interesting phrase, with this man, Ben Reitman. How many of you have heard of Ben Reitman? A few people have heard of Ben Reitman. Fascinating character who absolutely captivated Emma Goldman, this independent woman who was not supposed to be captivated by anybody. And this is one of the interesting things about her life. I mean, she was a strong woman and insisted on the independence of women and the strength of women. But when she fell in with, another nice phrase, Ben Reitman, I mean, she became, you know, absolutely swallowed up in this very, very passionate 10-year-long affair. Well, Reitman was an anarchist among anarchists, but he had courage too. They went out to San Diego, ferocious attack on them by the by all sorts of people in San Diego who saw anarchists, you know, as the devil, and Ben Reitman was really kidnapped, taken out, tarred into the countryside, tarred and feathered, branded with, you know, the branded on his backside with the letters IWW, the Industrial Workers of the World, you see. And he was the kind of guy who later, when he would appear on a platform, he would suddenly turn his back to the audience and pull down his pants to show them what had been done to him, which horrified Emma Goldman. But a lot of things he did horrified her, but it didn't stop their relationship. Until what stopped their relationship was politics and the war, World War I. And by then, Emma Goldman had spent much prison time. She'd been imprisoned on Blackwell's Island in New York during the economic crisis of 1893, of standing up in Union Square before this huge crowd. And that was a fierce economic situation in New York in 1893, all over the country, really, but huge numbers of people unemployed and people having not enough food to take care of their families. And Emma Goldman gets up before this huge crowd in Union Square and says, if you don't have food for your kids, go into the stores and take the food. It's called direct action. That's what anarchists believe in. You don't sign petitions. You don't lobby. You don't visit your legislator. You take direct action against the source of your problem. That's what workers do when they take direct action against the employers. And that's what women do when they take direct action against men or against whoever is the source of their oppression. Yeah, so she was in jail for that. And spent her jail record was a very long one. Then the FBI always had people following her, and the police always were reporting on her speeches. It was one of her speeches that they couldn't record because as the agent reported to his superiors, he said, well, she spoke to this group of Jewish women on the Lower East Side. He said, I'm sorry, I couldn't take down what she said because she spoke in Yiddish. by the time World War I came around, they both had spent quite a bit of time in prison, and she by now was a famous national speaker and lecturer and so on, and she began to speak against the war, against the draft. And you may know that World War I was an occasion for a kind of hysteria that happens again and again in wartime, right? In which people who speak out against the war look upon as traitors, in which the government induces an atmosphere of fear and makes examples of a small number of people in order to intimidate everybody else. In this case, in the case of World War I, they imprisoned about 1,000 people for speaking out against the war. And when Emma Goldman and Alexander Berkman spoke at a big rally in Harlem against the Conscription Act, they were arrested and they were sent to prison and not released until the war ended. When the war ended, that's when the Palmer Raids took place, which some of you may know about, but not far off from what is going on now with the treatment of immigrants and non-citizens. It's a wholesale roundup of people who are non-citizens, and no due process and no trial, no hearing, and you put them on the boat and you deport them. And Alexander Berkman and Emma Goldman were deported. Ironically enough, they're deported back to Russia where they had been born, but that was Tsarist Russia, and now it was Soviet Russia. And 1918, 1919, it was Soviet Russia, so they deported back to Soviet Russia, but they were still anarchists. And even though they had first welcomed the overthrow of the Tsarist regime, they soon found themselves in Russia at odds with the new Bolshevik regime, because they were anarchists, they were anti-authoritarian, they were anti-state, Maxim Gorky was putting out a little newspaper, a little dissident newspaper, and it didn't last long. They were rounding up dissidents. And so, they were opponents of the regime and soon left the Soviet Union, settled in Western Europe. Well, they picked a nice spot, the Mediterranean coast of France, and lived in a very modest way there, separately, but still friends, but still involved with things happening here. Berkman, sick, died in 1936. Emma Goldman died, in fact, while she was making a rare visit to the United States. And in 1940, she died actually up in Canada. But I said I wanted to talk about something else, and something else is about war and about the present situation. Because wherever I go now, I have to talk about the war. Because that's what's happening. And that's what people are thinking about, that's what we're talking about. People talking about terrorism and people talking about war. And so I have to talk about that, or else I'm not doing my duty to myself. And that is to move from history and the past into the present. And of course, Emma Goldman was an absolutely incorrigible fighter against war, and spoke out against the Spanish-American War, against World War I, and anarchists in general, being anti-authoritarian, not trusting governments. Can't imagine why they don't trust governments. But they are very instinctively anti-war. I want to introduce it because I want to hear your views, actually. I want to hear what you have to say about it. I really always want to know what people are thinking about war. I spoke this morning to Cambridge Rindgen Latin, an assembly of students of, 300 students or so, there too I spoke about the war totally, all about that. And it's clear that people all over the country have been bombarded with the notion that we must support the war, we must support the president, we must have unity, we mustn't dissent, you're either for us or against us. If you raise questions about American foreign policy, the retort is, oh, you're justifying the attacks on the Twin Towers, or if you say there are alternatives to war, And you probably know that people have been visited by the FBI for criticizing the war and the president. I mean, the number of instances like this have multiplied around the country. A retired worker out in the West who made a remark at his sports club critical of Bush was visited by the FBI and asked, are you a member of the sports club? Did you make this remark about the president? A young woman was visited by the FBI, and they said, we hear you have a poster on your wall with a picture of Bush in a very unflattering way. You mean we must flatter Bush? We can't have a say, but I mean, this is scary. This is, you know, totalitarian, right? I mean, this is, you know, they passed a Patriot Act, which terrorism is defined in such a way as to enable them to pick up, you know, almost anybody for anything they say, you see. Don't even have to do anything. So we're at a time when, we're at a time when it becomes even more important to dissent from the establishment and the president and so on. When everybody's crying, we must unite behind the president. It's exactly at such a time when we need dissident voices. And the irony is that it's exactly in times of war, that is, when you're dealing with life and death matters, that you're not supposed to speak. So you have freedom of speech for trivial matters, but not freedom of speech for life and death matters. That's a nice working definition of democracy, isn't it? But it shouldn't be that way. This is exactly when we need the most lively discussion. And so wherever I go these days, I try to contribute to that discussion. I spoke recently at Newton North High School. I like to speak to high schools. I spoke recently at Newton North High School. Spoke to a large assembly of, I don't know, 500 kids about the war. And after, about five parents reacted angrily to this, showed up at the school committee in Newton and said, why did they invite him? Why would you let him speak? No, really. But I say this only to indicate that apparently to raise questions about the war is to engender a kind of ferocity which goes against the democracy. So yeah, I speak against the war, and I'm right against the war. I have a little book coming out called Terrorism and War. By Seven Stories Press. I've written for The Progressive about the war. You know, on both pragmatic and moral grounds, I'm opposed to the war. I mean, pragmatic is simply from, you know, is this war effective in doing something about terrorism? It seems to me very clear. You know, you've carried on a war for 4 months, you've been bombing for 3 months, and the president is asking for $50 billion more for the military budget, $45 billion more for home defense. It seems that people are still worried about terrorism. Have you noticed that people's fears of terrorism have diminished because of the war, since the war? I don't see that. If anything, excitement is growing. And the measures taken, presumably to guard us, you know, Star Wars going to guard us. And so measures taken. So from a pragmatic point of view, what are we doing against terrorism? We're bombing Afghanistan. We set out to say, well, here are these terrorists. We're going to find them. Would that be dealing with terrorism?
You're listening to Howard Zinn on Emma Goldman, Anarchism and War Resistance. This is Alternative Radio.
We found this group and that group. We bombed the caves in Afghanistan, right? They said there were thousands of Al-Qaeda fighters in the caves. Well, they came up with a handful of people. Where are the others? Well, as we learned from the government itself, there are terrorist networks in 30 different countries, maybe 40, maybe 50. The number changes from day to day. It's like the numbers of McCarthy's communists in the State Department used to change from day to day, because the truth is they don't know. And so if you don't know, what are you doing bombing Afghanistan? they're sending, well, there may be a network in the Philippines, there may be a network in who knows where, in Syria, in Africa, in Somalia, who knows? Well, clearly, you know, we're bombing and bombing, and we haven't done anything about terrorism. It's as if a crime had been committed in, you know, a terrible crime, a mass murder had been committed, and you're looking for the perpetrators, and you hear that the perpetrators are hiding out in Cambridge. You bomb Cambridge. You, or the criminals in this neighborhood, you bomb the neighborhood on a chance that this might result in killing the criminal. This is what we've been doing in Afghanistan. I mean, it's absurd, just from a pragmatic point of view. And then from a moral point of view, well, a moral point of view, it rests on the issue of how many innocent civilians have we killed in Afghanistan with our bombing? And that's what my article in The Current Nation is about, because I felt, I was reading the, those of you who've been reading the New York Times know that they've had this page almost every day, right, with photos of the victims of the Twin Towers and the Pentagon, the little photos and little sketches, little biographical bits of information. Well, it's very moving. You know, tell you about who these people were and who their, you know, what they did and what they cared about and what their hobbies were and who their family was. It's very, very moving. And suddenly the numbers, 3,000 or whatever the number is killed, the number becomes no longer a number, it becomes human beings, you say. And I thought, well, we haven't done the same thing to the victims of our bombing in Afghanistan. They are numbers. They are just numbers. Just as the victims in the Twin Towers were just numbers to whoever planned those attacks in New York and Washington. And I like to think, and not specifically of the specific perpetrators of the attacks, but of the significant number of people around the world who sort of said about the attacks, well, you know, that's too bad. You know, they weren't that excited. They weren't that repelled by it. And they were sort of, I wonder if those people who didn't feel repelled by the attacks were deluded by the fact that they only knew about numbers, that the people in the Twin Towers were just numbers to them, and that if they had seen, encountered these people and seen their faces and talked to their families, that a lot of these people would for the first time begin to recognize what had been done here in New York. And conversely, if the American people could know, really know up close and see the pictures and meet the families and visit the hospitals of the victims of our bombing in Afghanistan, would the American people continue to support the bombing of Afghanistan? I suspect the reason the American people continue to support the bombing is because they believe Rumsfeld, because we have no one else talking to us. I mean, you turn on the TV, there he is. You turn off the TV, there he is. I mean, you can't escape him. And he is very calm and blithe. Oh, yeah, if there is a question, there aren't that many questions about civilian casualties. Well, you know, we try our best. You know, we don't really mean to kill anybody, a civilian. These things happen, collateral damage, right? Remember Timothy McVeigh, when asked about the children who died in the Oklahoma City bombing, Timothy McVeigh said, well, and he had learned this during the Gulf War, because that was a phrase used by the United States during the Gulf War to describe what happened to the civilians in Iraq. Timothy McVeigh says, about the children, he says, collateral damage. So this is Rumsfeld, this is collateral damage. And it's an accident, and it's unintentional, and or they're deliberately putting civilians in military targets. That always gets to me. You know, this village is destroyed. You mean they populated this village with ordinary people so that then it would become a propaganda weapon against the United States? It's like, you know, they created a Hollywood set for a and put the, no, something wrong with that. I remembered back to the Gulf War And here history is important. You know, when you're dealing with an event like this, the thing that's happening in Afghanistan, history is important. Because if you don't have any history to America's wars, if you don't have history to American foreign policy, it's as if you were born yesterday. And then whatever the people in authority tell you, you have no way of checking up on it. It's important to remember the lies that were told to the people of this country during the war in Vietnam. Lies about, oh, we're only bombing military targets. Then a million civilians die in Vietnam. You know, bombing, bombing military targets. And I mean, I was in Vietnam in 1968 and 1972, and in North Vietnam, and saw the villages, you know, 100 miles away from a military target, as if there were that many military targets in North Vietnam, villages totally destroyed by attacking jet planes. So the government, with some of that history, you know that the government lies all the time. These things are not accidents. When I say they're not accidents, I don't mean that the Air Force deliberately goes out to kill civilians. I just mean that they don't care. I mean that this is, because it's inevitable. When something is neither deliberate nor an accident, there's something in between, something that's deliberate and something that's accidental. And what's not, the something that's in between is something that's inevitable. And so when you do the bombing on this scale, it's inevitable that you will kill large numbers of civilians. And the number we have killed in Afghanistan, nobody knows. The Pentagon doesn't know or won't tell. And it's some of their responses, they say, well, we're not there on the ground. We don't know. And you can't believe the Taliban. Well, certainly you can't believe the Taliban. Can't believe the Taliban. You can't believe the Pentagon. But if you put together the dispatches that appear even in American newspapers, and scattered in the back pages of the Times and the Washington Post and the Chicago Tribune, and you read Reuters and Agence France-Presse, and you read the Independent of London, and you read the Guardian of London, read the London Times, and you put those scattered pieces together, you come up with a horrifying picture of the human damage we have done in Afghanistan. And that is a moral disaster. And we've met terrorism with terrorism. So I'm arguing that from both the pragmatic and the moral point of view, the war is indefensible. And people ought to speak out and defy the admonitions to be patriotic, using a very distorted definition of patriotism. Create a discussion about what is going on, or else we become victims, as people all over the world have become victims to their governments and have therefore allowed wars to go on endlessly, one after the other. I'll stop now. Yes, if Emma Goldman were alive today, what would she be saying in a way that can help us today? Of course, people are always guessing at what the dead will say, and very often, you know, put in the mouths of the resurrected figures, you know, what they would like to hear. But I think it's fairly safe. Fairly safe to say about Evan Goldman that she would be opposing this war. She would be opposing the government. She would be pointing to the enormous gap between rich and poor in this country, and the gap, and she would connect the war with the waste of America's wealth, the waste on the military, and the waste by siphoning so much of this wealth into the top 1% of the population. And I think she would connect what we are doing to people over there to what we are doing and what the government is doing to people here. And she was always a voice speaking out against the mainstream, press, and against all the institutions which try to corral us into acceptance of the official line. So, yeah, I wish she were with us today. We need as many voices, and she was an eloquent, powerful voice. We need as many voices like that as possible. Back there, yes.
Morally justified one?
Well, that's a good and important argument. Because, in fact, there were people, the argument is that the Taliban was overthrown by this war. The Taliban was ejected from power by this war, and the Taliban was an oppressive force in Afghanistan. And so that oppressive force is out, and, you know, that's an important positive thing. And so it may be justified to have, well, what you describe as a small number of civilian casualties in return for what you describe as saving millions of people. Well, I don't know. That complicates, the removal of the Taliban complicates the moral issue, because it's true that the Taliban was a horrible government. But first of all, the numbers of people who were killed in the course of this, then you always have to write, it's a matter of proportionality. There's something to that principle of just war theory, which says in order to consider whether war is just, you have to consider whether the damage you do is proportional to the end that you gain. And therefore, it becomes important to know what damage we did. And it's not just a few civilians. The numbers vary. Nobody knows what the numbers are. At least 1,000, 1,500, possibly 3,000, 4,000 dead as a result of our bombings. And beyond that, the large numbers of people, including children, blinded, legs cut off. I've gone through the press, the foreign press and domestic press, very carefully, and the stories are horrifying about what we have done in our bombing. And therefore, in order to justify that, we would have to find a very, very powerful and clear moral reason. And I don't find it. Because it's not, when you talk about saving millions of people, but it's also true that millions of people in Afghanistan have been starving and in desperate need while the bombing has gone on. And when the bombing started, the bombing stopped the truckloads of food that were going into Afghanistan, and we don't know how many people suffered. The bombing caused hundreds of thousands, perhaps over 1 million people in Afghanistan, to flee from their homes and to become refugees as a result of the bombing. So the collateral damage is not minor, it's major. And so on the other hand, and yes, the Taliban removed from power. Does that mean that we had the removal of an oppressive state and now we have a non-oppressive state? That's not clear at all. The Northern Alliance and the people who have replaced the Taliban have a record of what they did in Afghanistan, which in ferocity is very close to what the Taliban did. The Revolutionary Association of Women in Afghanistan, which is a feminist organization in Afghanistan, which is, of course, their first concern is women's rights and what the Taliban did to women's rights. They have opposed the bombing from the beginning. I would argue that the moral balance goes against the idea of bombing. Now, remember, we didn't go into the war to remove the Taliban. We went to war, but that's a side effect, right? It's a side effect. Because if we really think it's worthwhile to kill people, to engage in a military operation in order to get rid of an oppressive regime, we would be carrying on a war against Saudi Arabia. Because the policies in Saudi Arabia towards women are not much different than the policies of the Taliban in Afghanistan.
The removal
of Taliban is good, but I suggest that the cost, the human cost of that, and the unforeseeable consequences of that removal, that we don't know what's going to happen in Afghanistan now. After all, it isn't the intention of the United States to set up a democratic Afghanistan. It's never the intention of the United States to set up a democratic government anywhere. It's always the, I mean, there's the history of American foreign policy makes that clear. The intention of the United States is to find a government that will be palatable, that will play ball with the United States, whether it's whatever it is, left, right, terrorist, not, doesn't matter. So with the motives of a government like that, the future of Afghanistan is unclear. Here's the thing about war, just to make a more general statement about war than I've made specifically about Afghanistan. When you're thinking about war as a means of achieving a moral end, which is what we're talking about here, like the removal of the Taliban, war, it seems to me, always involves this. Involves the certain use, the absolutely certain use of horrible means, because that's what war is. War is always indiscriminate killing. That's what war in our time always is. War is always indiscriminate killing, whatever they say about smart bombs and so on. War involves the certain use of horrible means for uncertain ends. The ends are always uncertain. You know that in the immediate, the means that you're using are deadly. You don't know what the end is going to be, and we still don't know what the end will be in Afghanistan.
What would you say was the appropriate response to the attack?
And let me first, what is an appropriate response? You have a friend who's, somebody was killed in the World Trade Center. What is an appropriate response? And let me first say this. There's a kind of automatic assumption that the people who are closest to the tragedy, that is the families of the victims, for instance, would be the one most angry and most desirous of violent retaliation. It's not at all clear that this is so. There are families of victims of the Twin Towers who have gotten together and spoken out in protest against the bombing. And some of you may have heard recently that there was a group of Americans whose families were killed, members of families were killed in the Twin Towers or in the Pentagon, who traveled to Afghanistan to meet with the families of the victims of our bombing in Afghanistan. It's a remarkable event. When I was in, where was I? In Greensboro, North Carolina. I was speaking in Greensboro, North Carolina. I met this journalist, David Pretorti, whose brother had been killed in the World Trade Center. His father was a veteran of Iwo Jima in World War II. He said that he and his whole family were totally against bombing as a retaliation. Now, that doesn't get to your question, really, but it's a sort of preface to say that there are people who themselves were the victims who didn't immediately and automatically respond, therefore we must bomb. What would be an appropriate response? An appropriate response was, terrible thing has taken place. An act of terrorism has killed a huge number of people. It's a criminal act of monstrous proportions. Certainly we should find the perpetrators or find the planners, right? Yes, let's treat it as an enormous criminal operation. I mean, this is what you do when a crime is committed. You look for the perpetrators and you try to find them and prosecute them. So you must do this in this case. Using all the resources, international resources, intelligence sources, whatever, use all the resources you can to try to find a perpetrator. But you don't immediately bomb, because when a crime is committed, right, and you don't bomb the neighborhood. You don't bomb the city. You try to focus your attention on the perpetrators. Yeah, I spoke somewhere recently, and somebody said, and during the question period, somebody said, "Look, it's payback time." I said, "Well, who are you paying back? Have you found the people that you have to pay back? No. You're just bombing the country. What would you do?" So yes, what's the appropriate response? Yes, you set up an international police network. Understanding that even after, if you capture bin Laden, even if you capture, you know, some finite number of planners, that is certainly not going to deal with the problem of terrorism. The problem of terrorism has roots. The problem of IRA terrorism is not simply a matter of finding the people who planted these bombs. The problem is settling the question of Ireland. Problem with Palestinian car bomb terrorism is not, oh, we're going to find the car bombers, or we're going to retaliate by blowing up some Palestinian homes. That doesn't, and it obviously doesn't answer the question of terrorism, because the cycle continues. You react against the car bombers with more violence, there's another car bombing, and it goes on and on and on. So therefore, you have to look for the roots of it, and you really have to accept the fact, hard thing for Americans to accept, the United States has angered a lot of people in the world. Only a few of those angry people will become terrorists. But the numbers of angry people are in the many, many millions, because we are a superpower. We have sent armies all over the world. We intervened in countries all over the world. We have angered people all over the world. And out of those millions of people who are angry at us, yes, there some terrorists will come. And so we have to think about what are the roots of this anger, and should we do something about it, and should we examine American foreign policy and begin to do something about American foreign policy. Now, as soon as you begin talking about that, people sort of rear back and say, what? Talk about American foreign policy? You're justifying what happened? That's ridiculous. You know, it's as if a crime has been committed and you say, okay, let's find the criminals, but let's also ask the question, why is there so much crime in the United States? And why have most criminals come out of poor, wretched, desperate neighborhoods and taking drugs? Well, you know, what's the root of that? We can put people in prison and find them, but it's going to go on and on and on unless we do something about the roots of crime. Same thing with terrorism. The government doesn't want to do that. The government doesn't want to talk about that. Because for the government to talk about that would mean that the government would have to change policies which are very beneficial, apparently, to a small number of people in the government and in the corporate world who are profiting politically and financially from the building of an enormous military machine which goes on forays all over the world and constantly finds new enemies to attack. So, yeah, we have to do something about the stationing of troops in Saudi Arabia. We have to do something about stopping the sanctions in Iraq. Those things have angered millions of people in the Middle East. Do something about the U.S. support of Israel in the occupation of Palestinian territory. Again, it's, you know, not just the Palestinians who are right there, but people in the Muslim world all over are angry about the United States' support of Israel in this matter. So, yes, if an appropriate response would be, and of course you can see how far-fetched this is, for the president to get up before the microphone and say, I'm withdrawing our troops from Saudi Arabia. I'm calling for an end to the sanctions in Iraq, and we're going to put pressure on Israel to get out of the occupied territories and make a settlement with, et cetera, et cetera. And we are going to reconsider our entire foreign policy because we have troops in too many places and naval vessels in too many places, and we are seen and maybe with just some justification as a bullying superpower, and maybe we ought to become, instead of a military superpower, a moral superpower, and use our enormous resources to send food and medicine and aid and help the Africans with their problem of AIDS and help the people, you know, in other parts of the world. That would be an appropriate response, a response which, of course, we're not going to get from this government and this system, but which nevertheless should be put out into public discourse by the citizens if we are a democracy. Yes? That's crucial, the information we get. That's why alternative radio is so important. Alternative newspapers, alternative magazines. We're not getting the information that we need. Thank you.
That was Howard Zinn on Emma Goldman, Anarchism and War Resistance. This classic from the A.R. Zinn archives was recorded in January 2002 at Radcliffe College in Cambridge, Massachusetts. Howard Zinn, legendary historian and activist, passed away in 2010. This program is produced by Alternative Radio, an unembedded award-winning weekly series based in Boulder, Colorado. Since we began broadcasting in 1986, we've always offered AR free to all public and community radio stations in the United States and the rest of the world. AR is independent. Our sole source of financial support comes directly from listeners just like you. We feature such voices as Noam Chomsky, Michael Moore, Arundhati Roy, and Tariq Ali. To access our vast audio catalog, go to our website, alternativeradio.org. Again, our website where we are podcasting, alternativeradio.org. Series theme music is performed by the Kronos Quartet from Pieces of Africa. Joe Ritchie is our editor. I'm David Bar-Samyang. Thank you for listening.